Thanks again for listening to the Park Hills Podcast. If you want more information on things we're doing, go to parkhillschurch.com or the Park Hills Church app. So this very special episode of the Park Hills Podcast has both campus pastors sitting right here with me. Hi, guys.
How's it going, Chris?
Hey, Chris.
Doing great.
And Alex.
So,
well, hey, Jonathan.
We've been working on this idea, as Pastor Alex mentioned, at the Freeport campus, that we wanted to talk through the three views of this section of Scripture. First of all, as Jonathan and I talked this through last week, there's a lot of hard passages in 1 Peter and 2 Peter that create problems. And so what we're doing with this podcast, as we've pointed out to you before, is we're kind of just walking through, you know, pieces of the text or things that maybe are interesting to talk through for us, but maybe less impactful for the sermon, less important to the sermon. So when we look at 1 Peter 3, specifically verses 18 through 23, there's a lot of stuff going on there that, or is it 22?
Yeah, so 22. I was like, 18 through 23, yeah. There's a hot take. Throwing extra verses in there.
Yeah, all right. So when we're looking at 1 Peter 3.
It's really interesting in here.
When we're looking at 1 Peter 3, verses 18 through 22, there's a lot here to unpack. I think the key verse that we need to deal with today is verse 19. And then that will lead us into the verse before and the verses after. But as Alex mentioned, and I believe, Jonathan, you do the same in Winnebago, right? There's three views.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're gonna break down each of these three views. We're gonna do our best to sort of just show you what they are, explain where they come from. We're gonna give some pros and some cons, and then we'll end the episode with just kind of explaining why we land where we land and the reason for that. So we're gonna try to keep our biases to ourselves until the very end of the episode, but we'll see. You'll probably hear them drip through as we kind of talk things through. It's the very first view of this. Let me read verse 19 here and then just kind of dive into the first of the three views. So, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison. Now, I want to start by saying there's a lot of ways to translate this entire verse. There's multiple words that could be taken different ways. But at the end of the day, there have been three predominant views that have pulled out of it. And the first one, as we mentioned in the sermon, is seen in the Apostles' Creed, that he went into hell and proclaim to the spirits who are dead. So do either one of you want to begin to unpack that view, or do you want me to just take it?
Yeah, I can unpack it a little bit.
Go for it.
Yeah, the idea being that Jesus was in the tomb for 3 days. So what did he do? He descended into hell and preached to the spirits there, preached to unrepentant people. Humans is the idea there. And maybe demons are there too, but the idea is humans. Reflected in the Apostles' Creed, so we see, you know, he descended into hell. Mainly based on this verse, there's a verse in the Psalms. I don't remember. Do you guys know it off the top of your head that talks about Jesus? Like the King James Version translates a word as hell, but then more modern translations translate like Sheol or something like that. Chris, you can look it up while I'm talking.
I'm looking.
But it's kind of those two things put together. And really, this got popular with the ransom to Satan view of atonement, if you guys are familiar with that. Mm-hmm. Just the idea that what Jesus did in the atonement was because of our sin, Satan owns us, and Jesus had to go buy us back from Satan. So the idea is he died, and then the reason he had to die on the cross was so that he could go to Satan and pay for us. So we went and paid our debt, and then, like, got the bill of sale or something.
Yeah,
we're ransomed from Satan. Not really the most biblical view of the state of humanity in sin. We aren't owned by Satan. Did you find that verse?
Yep. So Psalm 55:15 is probably the one you're talking about. Let death seize them. Let them go down alive into hell, for wickedness is in their dwellings and among them. If not that one, then it's probably this one, Psalm 16:10. You will not abandon my soul to the realm of the dead, or let your Holy One see decay.
Yeah, I think it's that one. I think it's Realm of the Dead. And it's just an interpretive
Sheol.
Yeah, Sheol versus like a word that would usually be used for hell in that situation. So they take that. And I've heard that a lot. A lot of the King James only people point to that verse as like why modern translations are terrible, because look, they took the word hell out of the Bible and they're just trying to soften the Bible so it doesn't say hell. And it's like, well, it doesn't actually say hell there. So there's a difference between the realm of the dead, Sheol, and what word would traditionally be used for like the realm where Satan lives.
Sure.
So that's the first viewpoint, that Jesus descended to hell to make a payment to Satan. We want to jump into the second view. You guys got anything to add to that one?
Let's stay in this one for just a second, because sure. I want to unpack the ideas there. So Sheol, for example, is an Old Testament idea that talks about there being a good side to Sheol and a bad side to Sheol. And the kind of the idea predominantly in the Old Testament is that those who are believers in God are in the good space of Sheol. The bad people are in the bad space of Sheol. And there's some predominant theological ideas out there that when Christ died on the cross and rose from the grave, what he did was he took all of the people on the good side of Sheol and brought them with him to what we would call heaven now, and that the bad ones are either still in waiting or they've immediately gone into hell. There's some issues with that that we'll break down in just a minute. But I think when I think about this idea of Sheol, really in the Old Testament, Sheol is typically just the grave. You just die and you go in the ground. And so since you're under the ground, there's a space that some have translated underworld, or as you just mentioned when I quoted that verse, you said the realm of the dead. It's kind of wobbly and it doesn't really make a ton of sense, because really what they're just describing is the underworld. And the reason why they describe it as the underworld is they don't know what's down there and you're under the ground. So you're underworld, literally. And so since you're buried or you're in a cave and covered with a rock and you're, you know, out of the realm of the living, you're now in this space called Sheol. And I think the trouble that I have with the translation of the KJV that you just mentioned a second ago is to translate Sheol as hell is not giving Sheol its due. And the word hell is a totally different theological construct than what Sheol is. And the reason why I believe that is because you've got Jesus quoting about Abraham's bosom a couple different times, but specifically we talked about the Lazarus story, parable at one point. And the question is it even a parable? Why is he using a person's name? That seems strange. But there's this space where he's in Abraham's bosom. So there's this idea of you can be with God in your death, either, you know, right next to him, the good side of Sheol, or you can be cast from the presence of the Lord, which is the bad side of Sheol. I think to take that and to then set that forward to the New Testament idea of hell doesn't give it its due, and it creates a problem that some will try to answer by taking this verse and saying the prison that we're talking about is hell, when I don't know that that's necessarily what's happening. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges is, and I've had this conversation with many people, what happens immediately after we die? Because Revelation describes new heavens, new earth. We're not there yet. So there is some temporary, I've heard the term used, intermediate state.
Yes.
Intermediate state of people. We've talked about Lazarus before, and in the idea, well, the rich man and Lazarus, the parable.
Yep.
Abraham's bosom, there's a chasm, things like that. Was Jesus telling a story, or was he describing exactly how things happen? It's a parable, so it's kind of hard to tell. But,
the problem with all of that is all of those stories happen before his death, burial, and resurrection.
Right.
So it almost, I think that there's even more credence in the fact that he tells the thief on the cross, you're going to be with me today in paradise.
Yes.
Right.
And that's, I think, one of the reasons why I find that first position of this passage problematic is because he tells him today, you'll be with me in paradise.
Yes.
Right. But I have heard pushback that paradise could be the good side of Sheol. Because when we even use the words today, and it's not wrong, but we say like, I hope I go to heaven one day. I hope when I die, I go to heaven. Well, we're not actually going to heaven as in what Scripture often describes as heaven. And that term in Scripture even has a broad semantic range. Like it can mean many things. But the ultimate place is new earth, right?
Yeah. But I think part of what we're looking at with this position is to say, well, where was Jesus then? And if he did go down there, Where did he go?
Sure.
And what is he doing? And so to me, that what he the interaction between him and the thief on the cross in Luke is, I think, a sign of where he was. I don't think he went down.
What if he was just like dropping him off first and then had to go down? Like,
just had to swing by. I'll be with you for a second. I'll be right back.
Yeah. Like, I got to go do some
stuff.
Hang
on.
Yeah.
Just sit on this bench right here. I'm going to be right back.
I got to go do a thing.
I'm going to prepare a place for
you. I got an appointment. Like, I'll be with you, but give me a couple days. No.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree with you. Yeah.
And I think leaning into what you were saying before, Alex, about, you know, the purpose of his death, was it mainly to pay Satan back? And is that even the right view, you know, in terms of what Christ did for us on the cross? And I think we would say no.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
So, and the reason why this first view matters at all is, so the very next verse, we're going to spend more time on this verse with the next view, but let me just open it up here, the can of worms, verse 19, in which he went in and proclaimed in the spirits of prison, we just read that, verse 20, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah. So what this first view is, just to kind of clarify it for everybody so you can hear it, is that there are groups of people in spirit form, they have passed away from the days of Noah, who are in a holding place somewhere. And what Christ did is when he went and proclaimed to the spirits then are the dead who occurred at the time of Noah, and Jesus went and proclaimed to them in prison because they did not obey and they deserved the judgment coming to them. So if you can imagine it, the people that hold this first view, which none of us three hold this view, by the way, so we're trying to be as fair as we possibly can, even though we jumped on the cons train pretty quickly here.
But we're not going to slip any of our biases in this first part, by the way.
So the reason why this view matters at all is, like I said, is because of the early creeds. But their idea is that at the flood, judgment occurred. And now Jesus goes and tells them, I am right, you're wrong. It's been proclaimed to you now, you know the truth. So some, like I said, that hold this view would say, then the good spirits, the ones who are in the good side of Sheol, come with Jesus up to meet that's their answer for this. They come to meet the Jesus and the thief on the cross, and then the rest of them get sent down into something else. So that's why you do use the word prison there, because you're talking about this holding cell. And it's an interesting way to translate it. It's an interesting, you know, position on it. So the pros are, it shows up a lot in the early church, especially in the creeds. The cons are, we just mentioned a bunch of them, but there's a lot of reasons why this doesn't totally make sense. Part of the problem is, where does Jesus go? How can you make that position to the thief on the cross? And then on top of that, there's this just general understanding of, we don't know very much about Sheol, so to base an entire view on Sheol becomes a bit of a problem, because I know really good theologians in the Old Testament that I've talked to who have done it for a long, long time, who are like, I don't understand what Sheol is. We have no idea. And Sheol seems to be interacting a little bit with some of the ancient Near Eastern views on death, so such as the Egyptian view or the Greek view, the river Styx, some of those things. It seems to be the Bible's answer to that problem. But it's so watery, and I mean that not in actually water, but I'm saying it you go to grab it and it just kind of rolls out of your hands. Like you can't wrap your head around what Sheol really was. And so there's a bit of a problem with us building an entire view on that. And the fact that it's the word prison and not the word Hades or Gehenna or any of the other words that you would use for hell. Right?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. So the first view we're all saying no to, and that's just kind of where it's at. The second view that we're going to go in the order that Alex did for the sermon, because I believe you did the same, Jonathan.
Yes.
Your order. Okay. So we're going to go in those orders so that if you go back and listen to the sermon, the one that was done on May 5th from either campus, you're going to get these views in these three orders, and we're going to unpack it this way. All right. So the second view that we showed in the sermon is that what Christ actually does, and part of this goes back to verse 18. So for Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit. That phrase right there leads us then into the spirits in the next verse. So in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared. in which a few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through water. Now, okay, so I'll take this view because I'll be able to just kind of unpack it, then you guys can rip it apart and I'll rip it apart with you. So this view is that at the days of Noah, it was more than just a human battle that was occurring, that there was something going on spiritual, and that at the flood, the human participants in the sin of the world deserved the judgment coming to them, but also the spiritual individuals that were involved in that particular rebellion, Genesis 6, 1 through 4, the sons of God is what we'd be talking about here, that those sons of God who had rebelled against God deserved judgment, but not full judgment, because that's not coming until the end of time. And so because they don't deserve that judgment because it's coming at the end of time, they are now being held in a prison. And that prison is somewhere under the earth, so to speak. So it's similar to the idea of Sheol, but these spirits aren't spiritual beings from people. They're not like what's left over of us when we die. It's not like our body and spirit get broken apart and that's what we're talking to, but that these spirits would be what we would probably call angels. The Old Testament seems to call them watchers and a couple of other places in the scripture, and not the watchers in Noah's movie, which was terrible, okay? So if you're listening to this and you're going, well, that this view is crazy. I saw that in the Noah movie. The Noah movie is based on wild Jewish interpretations of the Old Testament that aren't even close to accurate. Plus, the guy who made that movie went another step further and then another step further and made them rock creatures.
Yeah, say a wild interpretation. Like, that seemed to be... That's like saying The Hobbit was like, oh, that was based on a weird interpretation. Like, that movie was, I don't know. We're not talking about The Hobbit here today.
That
but...
was the one movie, not The Hobbit, the Noah movie. That was the one movie I was about to walk out of.
Yeah.
I just got so bothered by it.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
And when I'm saying the wild interpretation, he's using a part of the Midrash that talks about there being some issues with stewardship of the planet, which he then utilized to go to an ecological event that was occurring. So what actually was happening was Noah was, you know, the one driving the Prius and everybody else was, you know, driving a gas guzzler and they deserved all the judgment coming to them. That is ridiculous. And these rock creatures, the Watchers, are that's ridiculous as well. So what the Watchers were angelic beings who had rebelled against God in some regard and had decided they wanted a family of their own. So they had had relationships with human women. That's what we see in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. And then at the time of the flood, all of their offspring, all the humans that were alive at the time are dead, along with their offspring, what we would call the Nephilim from verse 3 there. And they're all wiped out and they're gone, but the judgment still remains for the angelic beings. And so they are now put in, and this is where it's interesting to me at least, they are put in a prison, it says, in multiple different side books that we'll get into in just a second. So they didn't obey. They didn't listen to what God said. And so they were put in a prison. And now Jesus went to them in verse 19, according to this view, and says to them, I won. You thought you were going to defeat human beings. You lost. And I'm proving it to you now. And now I've got to go to my other place. Okay? So there's the view. I don't even want to start with any pros here because I don't know that you guys are open to that. So let's talk about what are the cons to this view. Let's dive into it because I have a few as well that I would love to tie us in. But you said that this is my view, I think. Or did you say that in the sermon?
No, I did not.
You said somebody holds to this one and someone holds to this one and nobody holds to one of them or something.
Anyway, yeah, I said some of our staff. I didn't put you up. Well, I think I mentioned this in the sermon and I don't know if we want to go there right now that some of what influences this view and makes it more compelling to me, not in some instances, is the connection to another book that was contemporary to Peter, or not contemporary to, but that his people knew. Yep. Do we want to dig into that right now, or do we want to?
Sure.
Yeah. So I didn't mention this in my sermon, but the specific book, but we're talking about First Enoch here. And the challenge is when we start talking about these extra biblical books, it can get a little scary because I remember being there. I remember hearing people, you know, they're talking about the Bible and all of a sudden they're talking about like First Enoch or even Maccabees or these other extra biblical books. And I just kind of throw my hands up, be like, oh, wait a minute, we're going Enoch now. Now I know we're in left field. Like, this doesn't sound right to me. So I didn't want to distract in the sermon, but I think there is some merit and some value here to understanding that Peter's readers would have been familiar with Enoch. First Enoch, and First Enoch helps make this connection. So that's maybe why Peter's mentioning it, because it would have been known. And there are some quotes of First Enoch. It's not it's not like somebody else is like, oh, trying to find some weirdness in here and just like, oh, this is some First Enoch stuff. It's like, no, Peter actually uses First Enoch explicitly. Chris, do you want to kind of unpack a little bit of how that happens or what that connection is?
Sure.
Is that what we're doing right now?
Or? Yeah, we can do it. So the First Enoch piece is worth talking about, and I'm going to do it as briefly as I possibly can. First Enoch is not a scriptural book. It does not belong in the canon. It is not, we have no idea who wrote it. We have no idea when it came about. But it becomes very popular in the world of the Jews. So this would be Israel as they come back into the land shortly after their Babylonian exile. So this book starts popping up somewhere between 4th century BC and 2nd century BC, which might be right around the time that, for example, the Septuagint is being written or a couple of other versions of the scripture, so to speak. So at this time, they're translating the Hebrew into the Greek. And so First Enoch is a book. The book that you're referencing is the first part of First Enoch, which is called the Book of Watchers. And so like I just told you a second ago, what the connection here is that there's this phrase used by Daniel, which would have been written just a couple hundred years beforehand, and Daniel's talking about these watchers, these individuals that sort of are in charge of the nations. So he says things like the prince of Egypt, he says the prince of Persia, the prince of Greece. The idea is that there's this being that sort of has authority over a nation, and that phrase later on in the book of Daniel gets called a watcher. And so people are kind of wrestling the question of what is a watcher? And so whoever wrote First Enoch is answering that question, what is a watcher? And then also going, okay, let's go back and use this as a sort of a commentary to look back at the scriptures. And so the First Enoch is basically like, I call it fan fiction of the first part of the Bible, sort of saying like, here's kind of a wild story of what just happened.
So
the reason why it matters to me is it's all over the place in ancient Judaism. And on top of that, the early church actually wrestled with, did it belong in the Bible?
Right.
And so the very first meetings of the canon, they decided, no, it doesn't belong in the Bible. But some of the big wigs of the early Christian church said, we think it should be in, but we'll agree with the council and we'll say, no, we're not going to leave this book in. It is wild. I'm not necessarily telling you to go out and read it. But when you read First Enoch and you then attach it back to Genesis 6, you're like, holy cow, there's a lot going on in Genesis 6 that makes more sense using this commentary basically to make sense of it. Is that a fair?
Yeah, and I think my question goes to, how did Peter's readers know and understand Enoch?
So it'd be like, I think that probably, I used this in a class that I taught recently. You know Crazy Love? You guys remember that book?
Yeah. Francis Chan?
Yeah, yeah. So yes. Francis Chan wrote a book called Crazy Love. And when I was a youth pastor a number of years ago, Crazy Love came out. And everyone read Crazy Love.
It was all the rage.
Yeah.
Okay. It was all the rage. Everybody loved that book. They didn't not read their Bible, but they read their Bible and they read Crazy Love. And then a lot of my students would say, Crazy Love helps me understand the Bible way better.
Yeah.
That's kind of what First Enoch was doing in the first century BC through the first century AD. So there's sort of like I said, it's fan fiction. People are going around going, oh my goodness. I didn't know that said that. It doesn't say that, by the way. That's one of the cons here, is that you're using a book that is adding material into the Bible that's not really there. However, the reason why I think it matters is it shows the way that the first century BC to first century AD, people that are in the late, what we call the Second Temple period, almost anybody who believed the Bible to be true was steeped in this book as sort of like what you would read at kindergarten recess or something, you know, like, oh man, did you read the Book of Watchers? I did. It's almost like the comic book of the ancient world. Uh-huh. And so they're reading it. They're into it. They knew it. And so there's no reason why Peter wouldn't then quote that book and say, oh, check out what's going on here. You know exactly what this means. And so the reason why I particularly hold to this view is because when we see spirits being non-human entities, okay, and we have prison, and that word there is prison, not Tartarus, which is going to get used in 2 Peter, which is a whole different discussion.
Right.
When we talk about the prison here, that there's no other place where those things go together, spirits and prison, besides him quoting First Enoch. So those are kind of the pros/cons of the view. Go for it. What else do you guys want to add to it?
Well, yeah, I also think it's interesting that the verse says he went and proclaimed. not he descended. That takes away from the first view. But
correct.
But going and proclaiming, it just the question is just when. When did he proclaim? Was it, you know, if you read verse 18, death in the flesh, alive in the spirit, in which he went and proclaimed. Mm-hmm. So that appears to be a post made alive in the spirit happening, right? So is that in the intermediate time before his death and resurrection? Doesn't seem like it. That kicks out our first view.
Right.
But it seems to be post resurrection.
It could be any time after his death and burial, possibly even after the ascension.
Right.
But that would be weird, because why would he go back down if he's there?
Right. And what is prison is prison. That's another interesting thing to me. And even as we look at this verse, the verse before, death in the flesh and alive in the spirit, that's not really a great translation, because if we thought it was flesh and spirit, we would expect to see sarx and pneuma in there as the Greek terms, but it's not. It's soma, which is more a reference to the body, and then psuche, or, you know, we get the word psyche from that, but more of like our soul. So death in the body, alive in the soul, soul being a kind of different idea than our modern idea of soul. But that's just interesting to me. If it was more of that emphasis in verse 18, when did 19 happen?
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
And there's no telling for sure. But the one other piece to add to this, and again, it's not a pro or a con, it's just the piece of it, is there was a belief at least at the time of Jesus that these spirits that are in prison needed to be dealt with. There needed to be a proclamation against them, which then would lead to them wanting to return to the earth and fight one last battle against God, because they had already lost the Genesis 6 battle. So now the goal is, we're going to come back. And so Jesus goes to them and says, yep, you're going to get your chance, but I won. I've won them all back. You did your little story didn't work. The thing that you tried to do didn't work. And so here we go. Which then, if you take that and then add that into the verses that are coming, dealing with the idea of Noah being saved from the flood and that being a picture of baptism, what ends up starting to happen, if you hold the second view, is baptism becomes spiritual warfare, saying, just like Noah was saved through the flood, now your baptism is actually a symbol of the fact that you have been won back by God, and that you've been taken, you know, in a good way, a prisoner. You've been taken prisoner by God. He has won you, and that's a direct slap in the face to those that are out to get you and the spiritual realm who's trying to push back. Which then, when you get to verse 22, he has gone into heaven, is at the right hand of God, with the angels, the authorities, and the powers having been subjected to him. So I think if you go all the way to verse 22, you start to realize this is talking about a greater thing than just a physical realm. It's talking about all the powers, the principalities, the angels and authorities are now subject to him. So he went and proclaimed that to them, told them that in verse 19, and then backed away.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So, I'm sorry. I'm a little caught up in the term went right now. Just because where and when, and I think the when speaks to the third view. I mean, it's an aorist passive participle. I didn't even pull that out when I was working on the sermon. Like, it's passive. So he was taken. Like, it wasn't him doing the as.
We'll get to that in just a second, because the third view does open this up.
Yeah.
The cons to this are, you're utilizing a book that is not actually from the scripture. Yeah. And First Enoch isn't the only one. There's also a book of Jubilees, but both of those are found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. They're very prevalent in the Dead Sea Scrolls. They both talk about watchers. They talk about spirits being in prison. So there's interesting elements there, but you're relying on something that's so far outside of the text, and you're going, well, that makes sense. So that's a con, and that's like a big con that you have to like wrestle with. And the fact that this passage is clearly talking about the gospel being proclaimed, and Peter's talking about we are believing the gospel from chapters 1 and chapters 2, and why would the spirits in prison need to hear the gospel? They're already cursed. There's no reason for them to necessarily have access to the talk of the Lord. So you want to say something?
Well, I mean, this passage in general is, you know, it is considered a hard passage, and that's why there's different interpretations to it. And I think part of the con part for me is it with the second view is what you just mentioned, Chris. relying on an extra biblical source to interpret. Because if you go to Genesis 6, I don't want to say it's a throwaway line about the sons of God, but it's not like there's a long drawn out section that talks about it either.
Right.
And so there's, I think, valid questions to say, okay, well, what really is going on there? Maybe we get some clues from an extra biblical source, but is that then something we can say with 100% certainty, this is then is what it is? So it almost seems like we're looking at a hard passage in 1 Peter 3, then we have to look at another hard passage in Genesis 6, and is there enough there for us to really say that this is what it is?
Sure.
I think that's my hesitancy or my concern with that view. And the other thing is that I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems if we're leaning into that it's the sons of God in the second view from Genesis 6, then it almost seems as if the flood had the purpose of wiping them out instead of the evil of humanity.
Sure.
Because it's, you know, Noah is kind of the new Adam, you could say, in a sense. Humanity starting over. And it's not, I think it puts more of a, the second view tends to, I think, put more of a focus on these spiritual beings instead of on the corruption and evil of humanity that God wanted to deal with. And why he preserved Noah and his family.
Totally.
And is that the point that's the point Peter's trying to make then? Is it the corruption of humanity, not the corruption of?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair point. And so my only little pushback to that, and this will be very brief, it would be, I'm not going hard on First Enoch. I don't. It is an interesting book to then add some flavor to this. But as we know, Genesis 6 has multiple different interpretive views. I agree with you that the flood is actually dealing with the evil of humanity. However, the difference that I think you and I would have based on where we're going to go with the third view in a second is the evil of humanity wasn't just sin. It was also a desire to have the seed of the gods, so to speak. And so I can't make a case where the sons of God aren't angelic because of the Old Testament. And anyone who's tried to make that case seems to fall short in my mind. So then I'm going, okay, so we've got angelic host doing something terrible. We've got humans joining them in that. That destruction needs to come. And the fact that Noah is blameless in his generation seems to suggest Noah's not a part of that problem. So therefore, he is worthy of being saved, so to speak, which gets a little dangerous because then you're kind of like, well, what does grace look like? What doesn't it look like? I totally get that. But to take it one step further, then that storyline does show up a number of other places in the Old Testament, but it's more obscure verse after more obscure verse after more obscure verse, which is why I think somebody then wrote First Enoch to sort of try to compile all that material together and say, this is what really happened. The problem is you can't use that as biblical because it's not biblical. So if we just said the case for this passage is First Enoch and First Enoch alone, that would be unfair. I see it more as color on the side. It's the color commentary of the passage, so to speak, which then gives us what's actually happening on the field. And we're like, oh, okay. It's not just another view of the sons of men or sons of God are not angelic. They're men, but
right.
Doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I would say functionally, First Enoch helps make that connection because Peter's readers would have known that, and yes. Peter would have known that his readers have known that. So,
which I think is the big point that I need to make, and right. That's really quick. Just and you can take over, but the idea there is First Peter may not actually be. He's not necessarily validating First Enoch.
Right.
He's quoting something everybody would have known, and saying, this is what happened. You know what happened. So therefore, this is what Christ did. He proclaimed to them.
Right. And I've said this before in like sermon team. You know, it'd be like if I, in a sermon, was just decided to bring up Little Red Riding Hood and, you know, was trying to make a point about beware of deceitful people. And I just made a comment like, hey, you just got to make sure you're really talking to grandma, not the big bad wolf. And all my readers would know, oh,
right.
We're talking about Little Red Riding Hood here. And none of them would think, oh, Little Red Riding Hood, that's a true story. That we all, you know, accept as truth, but I think it would make the point pretty well. It'd help people understand the point.
Sure.
So I think similarly in here, I know you know, Peter uses Enoch in other places as well, where maybe
so does Jude.
Yeah, and maybe there's some differences in those cases. But in here, yeah, I think definitely his purpose is that that connection is already made in their mind. Peter knows that they know it, so he can just go through this. And that's why I read that Dalton quote in the sermon to say, Peter's not being unclear here. The lack of clarity comes in our understanding of Peter and his original audience's yeah. understanding. It's us with the problem, not Peter's trying to veil his point to his original listeners and readers.
Yeah. And the only difference there, and I totally agree with that statement, that's really, really good, is Little Red Riding Hood is clearly a myth made up to teach something to students.
Right.
Whereas First Enoch is trying to give clarity to what they believed was happening in Genesis 6. Still out there. But I think that it's a slightly different thing. It's not necessarily a myth. It's sort of it's pulling from the Midrash and the Talmud. There's all these other things happening out there that are beyond the scriptures. Now, again, I'm not saying it should be taken as scripture, but there's something to it that's a little more than just a child's story.
Sure. Yeah.
And I know you're not saying that, but I'm just trying to clarify that.
Yep.
All right. So the third view, I think we gave that more than enough cons. So the second view is dead for some people at this point. And plus they're like, I think Chris believes that angels mated with human beings. Take my class later and you'll find out whether I believe that or not. So Jonathan, you know, Alex took the first one. I took the second one. You do a really good job of explaining the third view. So fire away, man.
Okay. So the third view, essentially what it says is that, that the Spirit of Christ is speaking through Noah in his day. So verse 20, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, which a few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through water. So I think part of where that comes from comes within the context of 1 Peter itself. So in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 10, it says, concerning this salvation, the prophets who prophesied about the grace that was to be yours searched and inquired carefully, inquiring what person or time the Spirit of Christ in them was indicating when he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the subsequent glories. So in terms of the third view of Noah being of the Spirit of Christ speaking through Noah, we know that we know this actually from 2 Peter as well in chapter 1, verses 20 to 21, that, you know, the prophets, when they spoke, the message that they were speaking was not their own. It was a message that was coming from God, you know, inspired, moved by the Holy Spirit. So, for example, Isaiah, when he is giving his message, it's not his message, it's the Spirit of God, the Spirit of Christ speaking through him, because it's ultimately God's message, not Isaiah's. And you could say the same thing about Jeremiah, about Ezekiel, Daniel, all the rest of the prophets. You could say they're not speaking their own message. It is the Spirit of God, the Spirit of Christ moving in and through them. And I think you could apply that to the case of Noah. So during his day, with the coming judgment of the flood and God telling Noah to build an ark, as he's building the ark, it wouldn't have been something that was built overnight. And as it's being built, he would have had, I think, people inquiring what he's doing, what's going on, and that would have given him the opportunity to, in a sense, preach to them the Spirit of Christ speaking through him about this coming judgment, you know, pleading with them to be saved by coming into the ark. But ultimately, they did not. And so the flood wiped them out, and their spirits are in prison because of their sin, and that's their condemnation. So I think that's kind of, is that fair?
It's great. And I think some of the really big strengths of this is, if you think about what we've done in 1 Peter so far, from chapter 1 all the way till now, he's telling us, be countercultural. Don't be afraid of how people look at you. Don't be afraid of preaching the truth, living the truth out, and doing so in such a way that others would be saved, that you're following the Spirit of Christ in this manner. Then using Noah as an example of that in the Old Testament is a great way to sort of spell it out, especially as the ark's being built. People think he's nuts, right? And who's vindicated at the end, which is really where 1 Peter is going to go over the next two chapters and into 2 Peter, is this, all we're trusting is the ultimate vindication is from the Lord.
Yeah.
Even if we pay for it with our life, even if we pay for it with our job or with our finances, if the world takes everything away from us, it won't matter, because you will be saved just like Noah was saved in the flood. You will be vindicated. It may not be in this life, might be in the next, but there's something beautiful about that.
Yeah. And also Peter in 2 Peter references Noah again, and there he calls him a preacher of righteousness.
Yep.
So again, it kind of ties into the idea of Noah preaching the Spirit of Christ, speaking through him in those days. And it also, I think, fits neatly with the context of Noah. I think that maybe is something that goes against the first view in particular.
Yes.
It doesn't have a direct connection to the context of Noah. And also, I think, in terms of the Noah being a preacher of righteousness here, I think also ties into the immediate context of the passage in chapter 3, verse 15, where it says that we should always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for the reason for the hope that is in you. And so we also then can be preachers of righteousness like mm-hmm. Noah.
Well, and I've been saving this for this very podcast, but there's another piece that a couple months ago, reading through 1 Peter again, because I've read through it a couple dozen times at this point, you know, making little notes in my journal. And one of the last times I went, I just underlined all the times that Peter tells us to go or be sent. And sometimes he's talking about the Spirit, sometimes he's talking about Jesus, which then fits the correlation of what you're talking about with Jesus went.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying? Yeah, so there's this sort of spelling out that I haven't dropped in a sermon yet, and I wanted to save it for this podcast. There's a strength in this idea of Noah preaching the message to the people because he is proclaiming something, so to speak, going about proclaiming yeah. something, you know, as he chops down another gopher wood tree and starts dragging it mm-hmm. back or asks a rhino for help. I don't really know how it went down. But whatever's going on there, there's a beauty in Peter saying, you're also not just sitting waiting for the flood. You are supposed to go and proclaim the good news of the Lord again and again and again. So, you know, as we talk this through in sermon team, views 2 and 3, in my opinion, are the strongest by far. One, none of us hold to it, partly because it just falls apart pretty quickly. But I think view 3 is super strong in a lot of different ways. One of the ways that I find it lacking is when we're talking about Noah preaching to the people of his day, that doesn't quite answer for me why Jesus is proclaiming to the spirits in prison. Now, granted, I know what you're saying, that Noah's preaching to the people of his day, but they wouldn't have been in prison at that point. They would have just been living on earth. So the only issue with this interpretive view that I've kind of tried to work through and figure out is, how do you then rectify verse 9? And I'd love either of you to kind of, you know, talk about what you're thinking there. But when we're thinking about prison, when we're thinking about spirits in prison.
You mean 19?
Yeah. Sorry, 19. Yeah, yeah. I keep saying 9. How do we rectify that in the midst of this view? Because I think it holds up from verse 18 and then verse 20 to 22. I think it holds up really well. The issue is, I don't know how that piece of 19 fits into this. Proclaim to the spirits in prison. Who's in prison? Who are the spirits then? Who is being proclaimed to?
Yeah. No, that's a valid point. I think whether this fits as well as maybe some would like it to, from my kind of looking into it, it seems to be that these are the spirits of those who died in the flood, mm-hmm. And that Noah's the preaching to them was done before the flood.
And so the words are ringing out to them
yes,
as they're in prison now.
Yes.
So it's not taking the first view and like modifying it. It's saying the words of Noah are reverberating in their soul, so
yeah.
to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I think
that they're awaiting their final the final judgment.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Right. And I think that's why I was going hard on the word went there, because it's a passive, or a passive and a aorist, which would be a past tense word. The past tense, is Peter using it past tense because it's past tense to Peter, or is he saying it was even before all of this, before Jesus walked on earth, that's when he went, that's right. when his spirit mm-hmm. went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison. Interesting that the word prison is there, not, you know, what were you saying, Tartarus or
yeah, it's all the using other. None of the New Testament words for hell.
Right.
Which is why I don't think the first few holds up at all.
Right. And then because who is the they there? It's the spirits in prison. So then the question is, who are the spirits in prison? Are they human or are they not human? And I think if you say they're human, then it really does make sense. The third view comes into view to me really well there. But that also is up in the air, that why are they called the spirits in prison?
Right.
Is that human or not? I don't think you can pound the table hard and say, no, it's definitely human, or no, those are definitely non-human spirit beings that
right.
the second view pushes.
So I think one of the things I want you to notice from this podcast as the three of us talk is, first of all, we take the text really, really seriously. Mm-hmm. Like, in some ways we maybe take it, I don't want to say too seriously because I don't know if that's possible, but we wrestle about these things and we want to make sense of it. And as Alex said, and I really appreciated it in the sermon itself, we don't shy away from the hard passages. So we're going to preach a book. We're not going to back down. We're going to get to these spots and we're going to tell you, listen, this is hard. There's a couple different views for this. And as long as you have a good understanding of why you believe this, which really is a callback to Pastor Cliff, that he told me this years ago, if you are an Arminian, I don't care, but you need to make sense of why these verses say this, and it's going to really bother you. And if you're a Calvinist, that's fine, but you're going to have to figure out why these verses seem to say something opposite your position. So you need to wrestle the Bible. And if you're going to wrestle the Bible, you're never going to go wrong. The first view falls apart as you just press into it. I think we've shown that pretty effectively. The second view can fall apart pretty quickly if you lean completely on First Enoch as a reason. And there's a valid reason for you not to hold on to First Enoch, and I don't, just for the record. Mm-hmm. The third view makes a ton of sense contextually. The only question is then what to do with that verse 19. And I think that's a valid interpretive view, that it's the preaching of Noah that's kind of bouncing around in their minds or their souls, so to speak, for the rest of time. So with that said, I think you can probably tell, you know, where we land, but I'd love to hear each of us just kind of say why we landed where we did and why, you know, or where we landed and then why we landed there, as long or short as you want to make this. So,
I land on the third one, that it being the Spirit of Christ speaking through or preaching through Noah in his day. And part of that is just, I think it deals particularly with the story of Noah in a way that's very helpful. I also think, as I mentioned earlier, the way that it connects to verse 15 makes a lot of sense to me. That we too can be preachers of righteousness, that we're not just, as you mentioned, Chris, sitting around and waiting for Christ to return, or, you know, not taking personal holiness seriously, another thing that Peter is drawing out throughout the letter, that we're actively living for him, speaking about him, prepared to give a reason for the hope that we have, and I think we can see that. We can see Noah kind of as a prototype, as a example to follow in that sense, and so I think that fits really well within the context, and I think it also gives a really helpful application for the passage.
Yeah, and I would land similarly. I think it fits Peter's intended point that he's trying to make, and then if it's the context of what he's doing, I also think. Included in that is some of the textual evidence with the terms flesh and spirit actually more like being body and soul. I think that he went, that term is open to being during the Noah times, not needing to happen after his death and resurrection necessarily. And then I think also when later in the past, in the verse, when it says, you know, eight persons were brought safely through water, it seems to be making the point that we're talking about people here, so that they, the spirits in prison, is humans. Now, the one pushback that I feel on that and why I'm not so strong on it is that spirits in prison, that phrase is never really used for humans. And I think this viewpoint would not completely fall apart, would be really pressed if that was not humans. So that's kind of where I can't like pound the pulpit on that and say, no, I know this to be the right view. That's the one weakness in my view. Mm-hmm. So Chris, where do you land?
Well, and I think just for the record, we all agree option one is terrible for various reasons.
Yeah.
Option three is very strong. And so there's no reason why you couldn't hold option three. I hold the option two, and it's bigger than just the first Enoch piece. I've gone on a little journey, and part of this was in my doctorate. And that's, I'm not holding that over you guys' head and being like, oh, if you just know what I need.
Yeah, if you were a doctor me,
that's what it could sound like. And I don't want it to sound like that. But part of it was a rabbit hole that I was introduced to 5 years ago that I've gone down, and I can't unsee a lot of different places in the text that are more, I don't want to use the word supernatural because the entire text of the scripture is supernatural. I don't want to say it's more, it's spiritual because it's about angels, but there's this phrase, spirits in prison, I can't rectify it with being the third view. I think the third view is super strong and I love it. And part of me wishes I could do that. But the reason why I land on the second view is partly because the scripture is just weird, spiritual, supernatural sometimes. And I have no problem leaning into that. And I don't think you two are taking option three because you're afraid of spiritual things. You know what I'm saying? Right. This isn't sort of a like, well, they don't believe in demons, so they don't want to hold the second view. To me, it's just, I can't back away from it at this point. I'm willing to undo, you know, if I could make the case strong enough for option three, I would totally go there. But there's a number of other passages that kind of fit into this in my mind. And at the end of the day, I'm going to go, no, it makes sense that what's being proclaimed is these spiritual beings that were in rebellion against God in Genesis 6 are being held somewhere. And Christ said, we won. And then in my position, Jesus basically goes there. I think all he needs to say is, I won. And then he goes and meets the thief on the cross in paradise, and he's like, let's go. And then he comes back to life and then frees the whole world. But I think both versions 2 and 3 are they're even closer to each other than they sound at first glance. I mean, seriously, the idea is we are supposed to be proclaiming against the powers of the world. And I don't think any one of us three would disagree with that, right? Because if you go to verse 22, clearly if you're going to preach the message of the gospel, it is going to strike fear in the powers of the world. So at the end of the day, I don't know that they're that far apart from each other. The question is just, what do you do with that phrase, spirits in prison? And that's where I land with option two. So,
yeah, and I think that view is very much in the realm of possibility. You know, like we said, view one, we're kind of like, I don't really see any evidence for that. These other two views, I think, are both very strong views, very much within the framework of evangelicalism. Like, nobody's— these aren't like hot takes, like, oh man, you've never heard this before. But you know, we can land on some different emphasis of the verse and still be okay with each other for the most part.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And as we've talked about too in Sermon Team, you know, wherever you land and you know, in this podcast, you can tell we're landing either in the second or the third. It doesn't it doesn't change the meaning of the passage.
No.
In terms of where you land on it.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something that is helpful. Us talking together as a sermon team as we worked through this, but also for everybody else in the church to know, like, there's hard passages. We want to wrestle with them. We want to be as faithful to them as we can. But we also want to make the point of the passage the central focus.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's why we didn't have this discussion in the sermon.
That's right.
You know, give it a quick nod, send you to the podcast, but hit the main point of the sermon. You know, Peter's just trying to encourage the believers that, hey, Christ has done some really hard things, and he's the example, and you can rest in that when we walk through some of those hard things.
Yeah, so ultimately the idea is, if Christ is preaching to spirits in prison, whether that be through the voice of Noah or whether that be these individuals that are, you know, kept in lock and key till later, preach the good news and you're never going to miss. And that's the point, and that's what the sermon preached.